instance, good evening.
Good evening, you heard nothing. Let's go this way.
Are you hearing me okay?
Okay.
There you go. There you go. My name is Dr. Scott Sheffield. I'm Vice President for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Faculty here at Brevard College. And I have a little bit of a scratchy throat, so bear with me.
Okay.
First of all, let me just say that it's a privilege for Brevard College to hold this event. The college conceives of itself as a collaborator in the community, as a partner in the community, and as a place where conversations, important conversations about issues can happen. And they always have here at Brevard College. The college has been involved with the Martin Luther King celebration for many, many years. We did a forum. I led a forum here on immigration policy. That was 6 or 7 years ago. It's very common. We have political debates here on campus in the Porter Center. So we played a very important role, and it's a role that we model for our students on how to have conversations about important topics and about topics which often have a diversity of opinions. So we are proud to do this tonight, and on behalf of the faculty, staff, and the students at Brevard College, I want to start by just welcoming to the Brevard College community. It is a community of thinkers and people who engage in discourse almost on a daily basis. So, that's the first thing I'm supposed to do is welcome. So welcome. Sit back and relax. My second job here is to get things going by sort of going through the script about what this is about. So I'm going to adhere to the script a little bit, so pardon me while I look at my script and make sure I don't miss anything. Okay? So, why are we here tonight? Well, that's pretty obvious. We've had a lot of recent mass shootings, along with March for Our Lives and other issues related to gun violence that have been going on in this country for the last several months and for some time. It's come to the fore of the national consciousness. That's why we're here. This particular event is called Time to Talk About Guns. I like the use of the colon here in the title. It's a grassroots effort to begin a civil, ongoing, solutions-building dialogue on this challenging topic. So a little bit about what this is and what it isn't. It's a civil conversation. It's what we call public or civil discourse among friends with different views on the topics of guns and their place in today's world. It's an opportunity for the audience to ask questions at the end of the program and hopefully of each other. Importantly, it's a time for discernment, listening to opinions that may differ among roundtable panelists and that may differ from your own opinions, taking time to reflect on and consider these different opinions, and deciding for yourself, knowing your thoughts may change over time. What it is, a debate or an argument, it's civil discourse. If audience members have questions, if you have a question, please write the question on the index cards that are handed out tonight. Pass the index card to the nearest aisle. And we ask that the person seated on the aisle raise their hand and the card will be picked up and delivered to the stage. Audience questions will be answered at the end of tonight's roundtable discussion. The goals for tonight's discussion are the following. Hope to accomplish the following. Recognize that we are all in this together and continue the dialogue. Learn to acknowledge and value our different opinions. Use these different opinions to begin thinking about possible solutions. And in the end, to use our energy and voice to affect needed change. Continue the dialogue beyond this evening tonight. So on behalf of our college, welcome. I'm going to turn the program over to the panelists where they'll introduce themselves and get the show on the road. Here we go.
Thank you, Scott.
And first? Yes, I'm Carter Haywood. I am the chair of the Religious Affairs Committee of the NAACP here in Transylvania County. I'm an Episcopal priest. I'm a retired professor of theology.
I'm Emily Ball. I am a blogger and editor, and I'm also one of the co-founders of a new group in Transylvania County Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense, which is part of a bigger national organization that supports both the Second Amendment and gun owners' rights, as well as common sense legal, as well as other community solutions to prevent gun violence.
My name is Dave Hunter. I'm a retired banker who, upon retirement, started providing concealed carry permit training, which is a business I was engaged in for several years. I'm an NRA Life member. I'm also a Glock certified armorer. And I believe I'm a gun rights advocate. Thank you.
My name is Phil Harris. Lord, you know me, I'm the Chief of Police. Just a touch about me as a person. My parents were gun owners. As a police officer, that's something that pretty much gets put into our hands from day one. I spent about 8 years on the tactical team. I was a sniper. So I have some fairly high-end gun training. It never led me to purchase my own guns. I'm not an activist. I have opinions on this tonight, but I'm hoping what y'all see is a sense of an attempt to really get the facts out on the table. I'm going to start by asking who's in the room, because I want to know how many are on one side or the other. So how many people in here are interested community members? Okay. All right, so I think we're all on the same side. What Scott, the way he introduced this, we're really looking for dialogue and, from my perspective, a certain degree of common ground. And I've talked with each of these folks extensively about this, either through email or in person. And I'm really excited about what views they bring to the table tonight. So I'm going to start by asking this question. By way of introduction, we've already introduced ourselves, but Carter, I'm going to start with you. Tell us about your personal history with guns and how these experiences have shaped your current thoughts on the issue of guns. There's three bullet points. I can add those as you go through.
Okay. Let me just say first, and I think I speak on behalf of all, probably everyone up here, how glad I am that we are doing this and how strongly we all support the mutuality of our respect for one another and for you, regardless of what your positions may be on guns, and how we're hoping that this conversation tonight can be can help us continue community dialogue and meetings and conversations about this and other issues that bug us all. I'm a Charlotte native who spent my childhood in Hendersonville when my parents fled the 1947 polio epidemic in Charlotte and wound up in the mountains for 8 years. And I want to tell you a little story that I've shared with my colleagues, and they felt that it would be a good way for us to begin. A story of me when I was 5 years old in Hendersonville. I got taken to the movie theater and, along with other little kids, watched Looney Tunes and other kinds of Mickey Mouse and whatever in the theater on each Saturday morning. And there was always a drawing of prizes at the end of the films, and my name got drawn for the first prize. And so I was called to the stage, pretty much like this stage here, and there I was at age 5. I walked on up to the stage to get my prize, and lo and behold, I had to choose between a baby doll and a gun and holster set. Well, that was no choice. I chose a gun and holster set. And I loved that gun and holster set, and then, but a little boy was the next person. His name got drawn, and he came up to the stage. And the man said to me, the man, the MC, said, "I'm sure that this sweet little girl will give you her prize and take the baby doll." And I said, "Uh-uh." So have a very complicated history with guns. More than 6 years later, six decades later, I'm an Episcopal priest, a retired professor. I've lived in Transylvania County part-time for 22 years and full-time since I retired in 2005. I believe my two primary contributions to our common life here in this county, the two that I'm the happiest about and most grateful for, have been to help found Free Range Center for Therapeutic Riding and Education, which is an amazing community resource, and more recently to serve as the chair of the Religious Affairs Committee of the NAACP. One of the activities I'm most excited about in our county is this Time to Talk, Time to Listen gatherings like this, which were launched a year ago by the Religious Affairs Committee and have since been joined by other groups like those who are here tonight. To help us try to bridge our differences, not so much to come to agreement, but to really respect one another and learn how to work together. Now, this brings me to the conversation about guns. I don't have any guns. I don't want any guns, and I don't know much about guns. There were none except my toy pistol and my childhood home, although there were in my extended family. My favorite uncle was, and still is at age 91, an enthusiastic duck hunter. With one exception, an adult cousin whom I loved, who committed suicide several years ago, I haven't lost anyone close to me to gun violence. Although over my 72 years, I've known people distantly, friends of friends, or distant neighbors who have died by gun violence, homicides, drive-by shootings, etc. The morning after the school shooting in Texas on February 14th, I phoned my friend Dave Hunter, and I said, Dave, you and I need to go public with our conversation about guns. Dave and I, as you will see, don't see guns the same way. We've had very different experiences with guns, and yet we've come to really respect and I think love each other as fellow citizens and neighbors with a common concern for gun safety. And we've talked a lot about this, and that's what brings me here tonight. I'll say more about this later probably, but for now, let me just say that helping imagine and build a culture of gun safety is a primary commitment of mine as a person of faith for whom promoting neighbor love and community well-being and safety are moral foundations of my efforts to live as well as I can as a person on this earth. And that, for me, is where the conversation about guns begins.
So I'm from Stokesdale, North Carolina, which is just north of Winston-Salem. I grew up in a gun-owning and hunting family. My husband and I are both gun owners and hunters. He's a serious hunter, and I'm very mediocre. I haven't shot anyone yet. for our dogs, which is my main concern, maybe. So for me, both growing up and into now, all of those experiences I've had, with my family members, my husband, our friends, our law partner, who used to be a hunting guide and is now a lawyer, and I can tell you we'd much rather be a hunting guide than a lawyer today. But all of those experiences I've always felt comfortable, I've always felt safe, and happy. And those have been fun and positive experiences. I have had two pretty horrific experiences personally that involved guns. In 2005, my uncle killed himself. He shot himself in the head. And my aunt came home and found him like that. And I'm just thankful that their son, my cousin, who is my age, didn't come home and find his dad like that. And then in 2010, I used to live in New Orleans. I was at home having lunch on a weekday, on my lunch break, and there was a drive-by shooting on my block, less than 100 feet from my house. And two teenagers were shot to death in that. And You know, to this day, and I'm 35 years old now, I have not told my mom and dad about that. Of course, if I told them at the time, especially my mom, would have, you know, they would have been really worried and concerned. And I think they'd be very upset now to know that that happens. And I could have easily been on the, you know, walking myself on the sidewalk or going back to my car, as it was, you know, two kids were killed. So my experiences, just my personal experiences with guns, have run that spectrum of, you know, very positive and very, very safe and secure feeling. You know, when I've been in situations with people where guns have been, you know, what we'd all say are in the right hands. You know, not only people who are responsible and law abiding, but, you know, unlike my uncle, didn't have a history of impulses to hurt himself, violent impulses. So, and then just, you know, as a lawyer, you know, so I'm very interested in this topic and the Constitution, and, you know, I've studied the Supreme Court cases and the cases across the federal judiciary where, you know, where our courts are, you know, where we're looking at, you know, what is the balance of, you know, individuals' gun rights and what is between that and, you know, what's the government role in protecting our safety, which is, you know, only part of the solution. So those have been my experiences.
Thank you.
I was born into a military family and raised in a military family. More specifically, my father was a career Marine Combat Infantry Commander. And so I was raised in a home where firearms of various sizes and designs were tools of the trade. We didn't have guns in the house, but my father worked with them all the time and trained with them. Whenever we go on base, we would see Marines drilling with their firearms. Usually we would have an annual family field day where the families all got to go out with their Marine family members and shoot guns. Just had a grand old time. My experience, again, with guns from a young age was it was just a tool. We looked at them the same way, say, a carpenter looks at a T-square or a saw or a hammer. In my late teens, I picked up hunting. Didn't start hunting until I was 19 years old and picked it up with a passion. Did it for a number of years, helped provide support and sustenance to my family. My wife has informed me that if I ever take up arms again in anger against Bambi or any of her extended family, his extended family, which is easily done in Thomasy Falls, that I would be on my way out the gate and down the hill. So I don't hunt anymore. Our family never did suffer any tragedy. We don't have any family members or close friends that committed suicide. We don't have anybody. I had some friends whose fathers were lost in combat. And of course, we went through the normal mourning process when those events happen. But those are things that happen when you're in the Marine Corps and other armed services. So, in my mind, firearms have always been devoid of intent and will of their own. They're designed to fulfill a function and a purpose, just like any other tool.
Thank you all. I'm going to come to you, Emily, with the first question. I'm going to read the question, and then for the audience, I'm going to tell you what else is on here. And if you've got a question you'd like to write and ask the panel, please take one of those cards and write it down. If you'll pass it to the end of the aisle and raise your hand, we'll pick up those cards, and I will add those to our questions. So the first question is, what concerns you, if anything, about the current state of gun ownership or gun access in our society today? The next question is, what steps, if any, would you take to address any of your concerns regarding the current state of gun ownership or gun access in our society today? Multiple fatality mass shootings have accelerated from virtually non-existent prior to the 1980s to more than two a year in the most recent decade, the one we're in now. What has changed in our nation to allow such a trend? And how do we change the direction we seem to be going with this trend? And then the last question we have on our list is, what other factors should we consider in addressing the issue of gun violence in our society? So the next question, Emily, I'd like you to answer. What concerns you, if anything, about the current state of gun ownership or gun access in our society today?
So I think that the thing that concerns me most, which I've alluded to in my opening comments, is really it's the issue of people with dangerous histories, criminal backgrounds, as well as individuals who have violent impulses, you know, towards themselves as well as others. And other unauthorized accessors, toddlers, children who don't, you know, aren't under the supervision of their parents or a guardian. And I think with respect to that, it's I think, you know, our organizations and my personal biggest concern involves closing our dangerous loopholes in our background check system. Because, as I've said, when I've been in situations with guns, with steady, you know, law-abiding people, the gun hasn't been an issue, like Dave said, you know. The gun doesn't have intent. It's that person who's accessing the gun. And they don't even have to have violent intent. So, I mean, as I'm sure many of y'all know, we have a private sale loophole in our background check system under federal law. North Carolina falls about mid-range nationwide in terms of the strength of our gun laws. We do require in this state that if you want to buy a handgun, even if you're buying that online or at a gun show from an unlicensed gun dealer, that you have to go through a background check process, which I think is great. But I think we can and need to do more to close those loopholes.
During some of our preliminary conversations leading up to tonight's event, Emily really hit the nail on the head when she pointed out that the issue is not gun ownership, the issue is gun access. And the wrong people having unfettered access to firearms of any kind. That really resonated with me. The thing that concerns me, as well as inappropriate access to firearms, and this is going to sound a little bit off the point, but I think it's really important for our discussion, is the nature of the debate that exists today, or the lack of debate that exists today. We don't talk about this in a way that is intended to increase understanding, increase awareness, identify areas of common support so that we can factor those into our decision making. Instead, the tendency is for us, and Phil said this very eloquently, and so I fell on the steelers from him since he's being so uncharacteristically quiet to me, is Phil said, you know, all too often what happens when we get into a discussion about guns is people consider about 5% of the facts. And then they do a deep dive into this, you know, really emotional place where really rational thought doesn't come out. I think guns, like so many other things, it's past time for this country to figure out a way to have an adult conversation about guns. Now, I do believe that in order to facilitate that conversation, it's important that we get our facts straight. One of those facts is that violent crime over the past 25 years is down approximately 50%. Property crimes over the past 25 years are down by approximately 50%. Pew Research recently did a survey and asked people, what are your opinions about the rate of violent crime or property crime? 60% of the respondents said it's up dramatically. When they probed deeper, they said it's up dramatically across the country, but not in my community. It's very similar to Congress having a satisfaction rating of about 10%, yet 98% of them get reelected. And that's because everybody else's congressman sucks. Mine is great. And so it's important that we really kind of get the facts straight. So these crime rates are coming down. Let's understand that, number one. Number two, the percentage of households in this country that have firearms is relatively stable at about 42 or 43%. It's not that every household is going out and arming itself in preparation for their last stand. It's about 42 or 43%, same over the past 40 years. We really need to get our facts straight, depolarize the conversation. The handout that you've got coming in tonight references an article by David Blankenhorn called The Seven Habits of Highly Depolarizing People. You know, one of those habits is to find the goods in conflict. Let's figure out what we agree on and work on that. My favorite one is learn to count higher than two. All too often when we get into a discussion on a topic like this, a challenging topic like this, we proceed from an assumption that there's really only two positions, you know, the right one, which is mine, and the wrong one, which is the other person's. There's a lot of things we need to consider. And the more we get into the habit of considering these things and depolarizing the conversation, the more effective our discussions are going to be. And so my great concern as we sit here tonight is the polarization on this topic. And we need to wake up and really have a grown-up conversation, go beyond that polarization.
Okay, as a person on the stage who has no guns and never want them, let me tell you what doesn't concern me first about guns. What doesn't concern me about guns is that many people really enjoy their guns, enjoy hunting, and enjoy target practice. What doesn't concern me is that people have guns to protect themselves and others. I have a very good friend who takes a gun with her when she goes horseback riding alone in the forest in case she has to protect herself or her horse. If I myself were in mortal danger, I would be grateful to be protected by a police person or a neighbor. So, of course, I don't mind people having guns to protect themselves and their loved ones and their neighbors like me. In a world in which there are guns, that's the reality, our world and our society, I have no problem with Dave and Emily and Phil having guns, and you. So what does concern me about guns? I want to cite two issues here, and one is about gun ownership and access, and one is about the gun debate. I am troubled by the presence of assault weapons and large magazines in the possession of civilians. Unless they are soldiers in war, I do not understand why anyone, any man or any woman, needs or enjoys a weapon designed and built for one purpose, to kill people. Now that's my assumption. Some people could argue with me about that or talk about their experiences. It's very different. But I believe personally that we must find a way to limit possession and ownership of these weapons. I also have a concern about the current state of the gun debate. I believe that the gun lobby, especially the National Rifle Association's leadership, not its membership, but its leadership, is holding our legislators hostage at both national and state levels. If you vote against the NRA's wishes, you won't get elected in most of the red states. If you vote with the NRA, you won't get elected in most of the blue states, or so the NRA promises. This makes it very difficult for folks like us to come together and begin to talk honestly and maybe even begin to find common ground, areas in which we might possibly agree. In other words, the NRA and other pro-gun lobbies have a great deal of time and money invested in keeping people like me from listening or speaking to people who enjoy and even love guns as much as I fear and dislike them. The NRA and the politicians they support do not want us to be having this kind of conversation. They do not want us to find any solutions to the problem of gun violence. That I believe.
Thank you, panel members. Let's go to the next question. What steps, if any, would you take to address any of your concerns regarding the current state? You know what? I think we kind of answered that one in this last one. Let's move on to the next one. And Dave, I'm going to ask you this first. Multiple fatality mass shootings have accelerated from virtually non-existent prior to the 1980s to more than 2 a year in the most recent decade. What has changed in our nation to allow such a trend? And I'm going to describe what I'm talking about. I'm looking out and looking for hair that's about the same color as mine.
Not too hard.
I remember the Charles Whitman incident at Texas A&M, the Texas Tower. And I say Texas A&M, I actually think that's University of Texas. But that happened in 1966. There was one prior to that documented here in the United States, Camden, New Jersey, 1949. Since 1984, there has been one after another. And when you look at the numbers, and this is kind of a rough number, per decade, we're looking at about 4. And as we hit 2010, it accelerated to 2 a year. So we're looking at 16 or so since 2010. There's been a drastic acceleration. So what has changed in our nation?
Let me give you the correct question for my answer, folks.
I'm all for that.
Before I answer that question, I would like to respond to a couple of things that Carter said, and I hope you all feel free to do that tonight. You know, I love you.
I know.
Assault weapons are not assault weapons. They're modern sporting rifles. They look physically very similar to automatic weapons that are used by the military. They are in most ways identical to any other rifle, with the exception of a couple of cosmetic things and the detachable magazine, which can carry higher capacity of ammunition. I think it's important, again, that we talk about, we be accurate in our language, and we talk about the facts. So if you look at violent crime, there's roughly 32 or 33,000 deaths per year in the United States from firearms. Two-thirds of those are suicides, and the other third are homicides. A very, very almost unmeasurable percentage of those homicides are committed with long guns of any kind. Bolt action rifle, a shotgun. I mean, it's really a very, very small percentage. I hate talking about statistics on a subject like this because I don't mean to in any way minimize the tragedy of these things. But there really are very few homicides that happen with long guns. They are fearsome looking. There are other guns that are not as fearsome. Rifles that are as fearsome look, that aren't as fearsome looking, that are just as lethal, if not more lethal, than the ARs or the AKs. So I think, again, this is an issue for depolarization. And the issue of need is very subjective. You know, my wife used to believe that I did not need my Harley-Davidson motorcycle. And her definition of need, she was correct. I felt like I really needed it. And I was a responsible owner of that Harley-Davidson motorcycle. I do have some long guns that look like combat weapons. I am responsible owner of those. They are stored and locked away. So I just want to respond. The NRA, I think the NRA, and I am a life member of the NRA, and I've had very dear friends tell me that as a result of that membership, I have blood on my hands. The NRA believes that in many instances, the things that are being talked about by other parties, really, when you strip away the veneer and the camouflage, they're talking about confiscation. We had a retired Supreme Court justice within the past month or so, in response to the March for Our Lives, call for the repeal of the Second Amendment. We had one of the March for Our Lives students were, and God bless those young people. I mean, the horrible trauma and tragedy that they suffered, that they have the presence of mind to respond in the way that they responded. Outright called for confiscation. Prohibition doesn't work. It's never worked in this country. It wouldn't work in this case. All it would do would be create a black market for the thing that is being forbidden, and the cycle of violence would increase because of the creation of that black market. That's my feeling on that. As for what's happened in the past 30 years, 50 years, David Brooks gave a wonderful speech at Davidson College back in January. It's called Trump and Afterwards, The Next American Culture. And in that talk, and Phil, I will be brief,
well,
if I'm able to at this point.
I was going to say, you haven't been up now, but go ahead.
He talked about what's going on in society today, and what Brooks said was for the first 60 or 70 years of the 20th century in the United States, there was really kind of this prevailing sense that we are all in this together. And people worked through problems together. We fought and won two world wars together. We came through a horrible depression together. Late 60s, we all know what happened. Those first 60 or 70 years were not ideal. There was sexism, racism, misogyny, all sorts of things going on. And in the late 60s, early 70s, the individualism tried to begin to resolve that. But there was a downside to that as well. And people were no longer in it together. It was all about me and what I want to do. And if I want it, I want it right now. And I'm really not too concerned about how you feel about things. I'm going to do my own thing, and if it feels good, do it, that kind of stuff. And that prevailed for a long time. And now we're in a position where that is kind of fading away. And are we going back into we are all in this together? And what David Brooks says is no. We're descending into tribalism. into our identity politics and special interest groups. And I've got my group of people, and I surround myself with them, and they're in the bubble with me. We've lost this connection. And it's this loss of connection, the increase in mass shootings in my mind, is a symptom of the loss of relationship, the loss of connection.
Let me just say amen to that. I think that the last 50 years have seen a major breakdown in our experiences of community. The community being my well-being as an individual feeding into and relying upon the well-being of my community. And the well-being of my community being as important as the well-being of myself. The two are inextricably tied, so I completely agree with you about that, Dave. And I think the last 50 years really have seen that, Phil. I think it has been since the 1980s that you could trace this in terms of what's happened in our economy and what's happened in our society. And I think resentments have built. I think what happened in the 2016 election really reflected that. A lot of resentments coming to the fore of people who are very angry about this. So that I think that on all sides of the political divide and all sides of the gun debates, we all want a society in which we all can feel at home, that we all can feel like we are being respected, that we are being listened to. I believe that with my heart. Where I would disagree with David Brooks, whom I actually like very much, although he and I are politically not exactly in the same place, I do respect him a great deal. But I think things are actually better than he thinks they are because of things like this happening. I mean, I think that this kind of conversation is not happening just here in Brevard tonight. We are beginning to have these kinds of dialogue and reaching across divides all over this nation, and that is a very positive sign, and that's what needs to continue to happen. And may I just ask you one more question about these long guns? Obviously, I am ignorant. That doesn't mean that my voice shouldn't be heard when it comes to guns, but I think when I think of Sandy Hook, when I think of the Pulse nightclub, when I think of the guy who went into the Waffle House the other night, when I think of the guy in Las Vegas, the numbers of people that are able to be killed so quickly before anybody can do anything absolutely horrifies and terrifies me. And when I hear a boy saying, as a friend of mine in Conestoga did the other day, he doesn't even want to go to public school anymore because he's scared. This is something we've got to be concerned about. And I know that violence is not limited to I don't know what to call them, but the kinds of guns that can shoot 50 people in 5 seconds. You know, I know that that's not where most gun violence is. I know that most gun violence is suicide and drive-by shootings in our cities and the kinds of things we don't hear anywhere near enough about. But I think we need to do something about not only the breakdown of community, but to try to bring some gun sense into the conversation about how we do gun lovers and gun people who fear guns and people who love guns alike, how we can bring some sense to bear. And maybe this is where we should turn to moms demanding guns.
Well, I think that's a really big question about what are all of the factors. I mean, like Dave has said, you know, overall gun violence and crime in this country are down. And we do know from the internet and the distorting effect of the internet and other ways in which we all, I think, naturally identify with our tribe or our group. We find groups that affirm exactly what we think and don't challenge us or present other sides of experience to that. However, I think with respect to the question about mass shootings, obviously don't have all the answers to that, but looking at one of the biggest studies, which is a window of time between 2009 and through 2016. And I know that there are different ways to define mass shootings. If we're looking at it in the way that this particular study does and is commonly through public health agencies, FBI and other law enforcement agencies done. I don't feel like I'm as excited as y'all. I get really into the drive, legal side. But there were, according to this study, 156 mass shootings between 2009 and 2016. So looking at those studies, what are some of the facts that characterize them? In over half of them, and 54%, they were connected to domestic or family violence. In almost half of them, the shooter showed warning signs beforehand. And that's one other thing, you know, I neglected to say earlier. I mean, my chief concern and what I think in terms of the law would be the most impactful in closing are background check loopholes. So there is no situation where someone can just buy one, no questions asked. But also red flag laws, which we don't have here in North Carolina. You know, several states have passed in the last few months since Parkland. Governors who are both Republican in Florida and Vermont have signed these laws into effect. In Vermont, the day after this group of laws were signed into effect last month, an 18-year-old high school student was stopped from buying a gun. He had a diary about how he wanted to perpetrate the greatest school mass shooting with the most deaths in U.S. history. So I don't pretend or claim to have the answers, nor do I think at all that the law can fix all the problems. I mean, every day people get in their cars drunk. Every day people steal, and they break laws, and people are damaged by breaking those laws. But we don't make the same futility argument that those laws aren't still very effective. So I do think with mass shootings, you know, looking at domestic violence situations and people who have that history, that's common in these mass shootings. Looking at red flag laws, and that doesn't just mean potential mass shooters, which like Dave said, is actually a very, you know, very small percentage of our annual gun deaths are from mass shootings. I think it's around 1%. Of course, those are the ones we hear about because they are so horrific. But those red flag laws also apply to individuals who express suicidal impulses. And I should stop. I jumped into that. What the red flag laws are, in essence. So, those allow family members or law enforcement, if there is an individual that they're connected to who is showing a history of violent impulses towards themselves or others, you present that to a court, and that gives the judge, upon reviewing that evidence, the authority, if they find evidence, to issue a temporary restraining order on that person's ability to buy a gun, just like what happened with this potential shooter in Vermont last month. It also authorizes law enforcement to temporarily take any firearms in that individual's possession. We know that these things are not foolproof, but that is a common, it's almost 50% of those mass shootings from that time period. Last thing I'll say about that is in over a third of those mass shootings, the shooter would have failed, they were prohibited from buying a gun in the first place. And in most of those cases, they were able still legally to buy a gun, no questions asked, by going to a gun show, going online. We know some of those shooters also stole their guns. Some of them got them from family members. But, you know, when I look at those mass shootings just from the perspective of what the law can do, you know, looking at these just common denominators in these situations, domestic violence, history of violent impulses or behavior, these loopholes, I think that that's part of the solution.
And part of it, mass shootings are tragic, and they generate a lot of headlines, and rightfully so. They really gin up our feelings about the sense of tragic loss. The Virginia Tech mass shooting was done with pistols. The Gabby Giffords mass shooting was done with pistols. The Washington Navy Shipyard mass shooting was done with a shotgun, a pump shotgun. It really is the intent of the person wielding the weapon. They can make it as lethal as they want to make it. and 70% of mass shootings are carried out with pistols, not with long guns. So it's an issue of proportionality. And when Emily talked about red flag laws, that really resonates with me. Nicholas Cruz, Parkland, Valentine's Day this year. This young man walks onto campus with an AR-15 and in a period of 4 minutes kills 17 students, wounds another 17, sets the rifle down, and walks away. Now, over the course of the prior 10 years, the numbers are staggering, the interaction that happened. The Broward County Sheriff's Department in the prior 10 years had 23 calls about Nick Cruz. They had been out to his home 40 times in 10 years. But because he was not a felon, because he had not been involuntarily committed for mental health care, he was able to go into a gun retailer and legally purchase the firearm that he used in that attack. It occurs to me that it might make some sense that we perhaps, if we've got some gun guys here tonight from Bear Arms in the front row who are in the business of training on firearms but also selling firearms and equipment, who do background checks on every firearm that they sell. If we were to develop a system of augmented background checks, and I don't know how we do it, it's just an idea, but you know, if the cops have been to your house 40 times in 10 years, maybe make a little check mark next to that name. And when they come in to purchase a firearm and you find a little check mark, you explain to that person, we're going to have to do some additional investigation. Not that the firearms, I'm seeing Dennis shake his hand because no. And I don't know the answer how to do it, the mechanics of it. It's going to take us some time to really figure out if we want you to have this. It's just something we've got to do a better. It's in my mind, that's an instance where we plug another hole in the background checks. And all too often, it's these people that have unauthorized illegal access to firearms that are creating these horrible situations.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hang on one second. What I'm saying, I'm the moderator. I'm in the middle, and I'm trying to frame our discussion in some ways, and you see what we began with. We have panelists that have different opinions. But what I'm looking for is what we have in common and how we can put together something that we can agree upon and then move forward. And I'm not talking necessarily about us tonight. I'm talking about our society. It has to start somewhere. Why not with us? So each panelist had some really good points about this. Carter's expressing a concern about what has been characterized as an assault weapon. We saw an image of that from the Waffle House a week ago. Here's this military-looking weapon. What a gun enthusiast would say is you can't define that weapon any differently than you can define the Glock that I happen to be wearing. By the way, am I the only one with a gun here tonight? I'm supposed to be, because there are signs out there that say. So I'm just making sure. If we follow the rules, things go well. But back to the assault weapon, it's hard to define that otherwise, and a sportsman will give us an explanation as to why that particular weapon is their weapon of choice for sport. Is that the problem? Well, on one side, I don't think it is, because, as Dave said, the Virginia Tech incident was handguns. And when I look at the history, he's right, the majority of them were handguns. But when I look at Columbine that happened in 1999, and then start looking at the high number of deaths at these incidents, when we hit about 2009, it's heavily semi-automatic rifles. So is there an issue with that? And I think if we stand on each side of the stage and scream each other, get rid of the semi-auto, well, you can't define it, and it's okay for a sportsman to use it. At what point do we try and say, okay, let's stop talking about that. Let's talk about other issues. Emily brought up the way somebody can buy a weapon without that background check. That concerns me as not only as a police officer, but as a citizen. When I'm imagining that there is some kind of a background check, and I understand that that doesn't take place everywhere, if I really want a weapon and I can't get it in North Carolina, but I can in South Carolina or Texas, guess where I'm going to go? It's a day trip turnaround. So I've got it. And in fact, some of these incidents, we have seen that. If you have a family member that is supporting your poor choices, in some ways your difficulty in fitting in to society by handing you a weapon when you are not legally allowed to have it, that creates a problem. That seems to be what happened in Tennessee at the Waffle House. So, community-wide, what do we do that can start fixing some of the problem? I'm going to address one other thing that Dave mentioned, the 40 calls the police went on in Broward County. I haven't seen every detail of that. But I can tell you that in my experience in law enforcement, we've got two ways to respond to calls for service. The short term is this call. So I go and handle this call. Maybe it takes me 15 minutes, maybe it takes me an hour. But when I drive away from that address, the call is handled, it's in my rearview mirror. I don't pass information on to the next shift. I don't think about it again until my shift comes back and I go back to that same residence. And if I handle it just for that period of time, we may go out there 50 times in a year. If we look back, can we see that there's a problem if we respond 50 times? Absolutely. If I only responded there once as that individual officer, maybe I didn't perceive that there's an issue. I ask my staff to look for those ongoing issues and find solutions. What are those solutions? Most of the time, it's not police solutions. Sometimes it's finding a need that family has and providing it. It might be a fight because the family's hungry or because they're constantly stressed for money issues, or there's a noise in the neighborhood that keeps them up at night and they lose their ability to think rationally and to be patient. How do we as a community solve those things? And that's what we're trying to do as a police agency. And if I could go around, and a lot of you in the audience, I know where you're serving this community. And I think that's what makes us different. In Brevard, in the last 10 years, we've had two homicides. Pretty surprisingly, they've both been with knives. We've had shootings. We've had shootings into homes, into the air. We've had people injured in violence and anger with guns. We haven't had homicides. I asked my deputy chief, who's been here about 15 years, when's the last one we had homicide with a gun in our community? He couldn't recall one. So part of what I'm saying is we're unique here. I think in some ways we're trying to fix a problem that we're seeing coming into our community through the news, through the media, in various ways. And we're all concerned because there's no gate, no test you have to pass to come into Transylvania County. But The question for us is day to day, what do we do to prevent? How do we serve our neighbor? How do we take that young person that we see playing in the street alone? We think they're being neglected. How do we serve that family? There's a way to do it. And I think we're trying to find that. How do we do it better? That's part of what I'm all about in our community. So, I've got a bunch of questions. I want to ask the last question that we've got on our list, and then I'm going to try and get to some of these. And what I'm also going to try and do is not go back over ground that we've already covered. So, the last question, what other factors, and Carter, this one's to you, what other factors should we consider in addressing the issue of gun violence in our society?
Wow. I think the most important thing for us to talk about, not only here, but throughout our lives, in our religious communities, in our homes, in our schools, in the police department, in the NAACP, in Bear Arms, wherever we go and are talking about gun safety and community safety, we need to really talk about how it is we can build together a culture of mutual respect. I noticed one of these questions here has to do with parents and role of parents in all of this. Well, you know, of course, parents and families have a huge role in this. It's not all their responsibility, but families and teachers and clergy and rabbis and principals and all of us need to be involved in conversations about how we help our kids, how we help our young adults experience themselves as worthy human beings, as people that are deserving of mutual respect with each other and with us. It's a major, major, major sort of spiritual, moral problem facing all of us on all sides of the political divide. This is not about being a Democrat or a Republican or a Libertarian or a Christian or a Jew or an atheist or a gun lover or a gun hater. It's about how we respect one another. I think in terms of the gun conversation in particular, the more conversations that can happen, like happened between Dave Hunter and me, the better. Because Dave and I would not be natural conversationalists in the realm of guns. But because we knew each other through his wonderful wife, Donna, who's sitting out here, because she's on the free reign board with me, and because I had come to love Donna and Dave, I trusted Dave. And when I heard that Dave taught concealed carry, I thought, oh my goodness, I should talk to Dave Hunter and find out more about this. I think we've got to talk to each other. I see the guys from Bear Arms here, who I'm probably the last person in the world y'all want to talk to, but we probably should talk to each other. You know, we really probably should talk to each other just to get to know each other as people, just have coffee, this kind of thing. That's the kind of thing we need to do more of, because I have a feeling that at the end of that conversation, we might even like each other. We might not like each other's positions, but we might really like each other. But that needs to happen. It needs to happen more often. It needs to happen all over this county and all over these United States.
So I would second that, and not as eloquently as Carter, but I do think that when this topic comes up, people break down because they feel culturally attacked. They feel like their values, especially their conservative values, and on that side, I think, are being attacked or being criticized. The control and sense of control and security that I think guns give a lot of us is being attacked and being tried to taken away by, at worst, just like, you know, people who do not mean well, and by, at best, by well-meaning but naive and ill-informed liberal people. And so I think that's a big part of the problem, and I think that, you know, we're not going to agree about every solution, especially on the legal side. But I think that Brevard, like you said, though, like we really do, we have a history already here that we need to build on as a community, and I think we can. And I think the diversity of the people in this room tonight shows that. So I think really being able to, and maybe avoid having these conversations on the internet. I think probably a lot of us have seen this go down on Facebook, and people coming from both sides just lashing out at one another and really attacking one another when their emotions are totally legitimate and they need to be able to express those and their concerns, but that's not the right way to go about it, and probably rarely, if at all, the right platform for it. So I really do hope that we can continue to build on what we're trying to do in our community. We all have the same concerns about gun violence. I think we all have the same concerns, though, also about individuals wanting to feel respected and not attacked for their gun rights or their concerns about their gun rights. So I hope we can do that together, and I think that's just an essential part of approaching these solutions from a rational, common sense, mutually respectful way.
And I would add my voice to that of Carter and Emily about continuing this dialogue and building relationships and building connections. There's one more thing I would mention. If I were king for a day, and my wife suggests that I often think that I am, I would start a really serious adult conversation about criminal justice reform. These problems do not exist of themselves in a vacuum. They are interdependent. 45 years ago, we had 300,000 prisoners incarcerated across the United States. Federal, state, local jail prisons. We're now pushing close to 3 million. And a lot of those people are nonviolent drug offenders. And the way it translates, it's not intention, I don't think, but I think the way it translates into certain of these people's lives is we take the worst instant in their life, we take the worst decision they have made in their life, and we tag them with it for the rest of their lives. We give them the mark of Cain of being a felon. And being a felon, nonviolent felon, can often mean an inability to secure employment, an inability to secure housing, loss of franchise, and it just ratchets up over time. Somebody gets one little beef, one little bad moment, and they go into the system and they never come out. And it's reflected in the level of incarceration in this country. We really need to move from, in the case of drugs, which we've spent $1.5 trillion on the war on drugs in the past 45 years. We spend $50 to $75 billion a year in this country on the war on drugs. We spend $90 to $100 billion per year in incarceration. We have 4.5% of the world's population. We have 22% of the world's prison population. There's a disconnect there. There's something terribly wrong, and we need to address that. And I believe by beginning to address that, we will begin to address the issue of violence in our society as well.
This is a stat I looked at because there was a group that I work with, the Child Fatality Task Force. It's a state group, and I get information from that. I, I get information from that I bring back to Transylvania County and try and put forth. So here's the question. What was the highest time, the number of beds for the mentally ill in our nation? And the answer is 1959. How many beds? 600,000. Now, I'm looking out. I was 2 years old then. I don't remember much about 1959. Some people may. But what I've seen in my lifetime is a decline of that number. So what is the number today? 600,000. Somebody give me a shout out. Some of you might know the number. I'm sorry? This is nationwide. 40,000 is pretty close. It's around 45. Okay, our population is almost double. So if we did the population and made it the same as 1959, we'd have about 1.1 million beds, and we've got 45,000. We have about 3% of the number that we had then. I think we'd also agree, if we could do a little study, that in 1959 we had too many people in those hospitals. A lot of them were learning disabled. They didn't belong there. Some did, but not 600,000. But what are we doing with our mentally ill now? Well, I believe they're in jails and prisons.
Homeless.
I think a lot of them are walking our streets and nobody is capable of loving them because they've worn down those that were close to them. Or they lost those loved ones to death or some other issue. What are we doing to serve those people? Meridian put together a group that's actually studying how to better serve our mentally ill population. And they have partnered with the Sheriff's Office and the Police Department. And we're working on doing that. And I can tell you that since that group convened about a year and a half ago, I have better access to options for those that are mentally ill. So that's one of those small pieces, I think, that matters.
Can I also say another big piece, I believe, of any conversation about violence in our society? In this society of ours, we have to deal with race and racism and the role that plays in violence and in gun violence. And I am haunted by the proliferation of drive-by shootings in our cities. These are not usually considered mass shootings, although sometimes they are. But so often it is African American and Latino children who are dying at the hands of gun violence in our cities. And that is a huge part of this problem.
It's evident to me that people of color and people of different income levels have a different experience than me. That's evident. But as a community, how can we close the gap and help solve some of those differences? And a lot of that seems to be service. Some of it is finding somebody to help, somebody to show care and love to. A couple of questions in here that seem to be popping up more than once. School bullying. Kids and young people are cruel. What are we doing to start working at school to reduce the bullying? Is that one of those trends that we're seeing? The bullied are showing up at the schools with guns. Maybe we are doing something, but maybe we can do something. I'll ask that question in those two ways.
Sure. So I am a board member at our Boys and Girls Club here in town, which is one of many really wonderful organizations in town. And I do think that I don't think human nature is any different than it was, but it seems to me, and my husband and I have talked about this a lot, we graduated in 99 and 2000 respectively, he is older than I am, and we graduated right before this time of social media and smartphones. I think that, of course, I was a junior in high school when Columbine happened, so mass shootings were happening very much on my mind when I was that age. But I think it seems like it has gotten worse. I don't know how much of that is hearing about it more, feeling it's being amplified through what we hear in the media. But certainly I think that internet and the role of technology, it's just so easy to carelessly say something, thoughtlessly say something, and that can just destroy someone who's 13, 15 years old. I think also the internet can be a really harmful outlet for someone who feels that isolation, who feels, you know, angry and feels impotent, and they just want to be respected, and they just want to be, you know, they just want to assert themselves with their classmates. So I certainly think that organizations like the Boys and Girls Club, you know, and law enforcement and the churches, other groups in our community, mentorship, you know, is so important. You know, mass shootings are rare. They're important because you could prevent someone from going down that track. More likely, you're going to prevent someone from going down a million other tracks that are also horrible. So I think that those proactive community solutions are absolutely part of the problem. I'm part of the solution.
So. If I could say something on that. As a military kid, we moved every couple of years, and so I was constantly bullied. I was always the new kid. But because of my size, and because of my father's insistence, I usually dealt with it myself. It's a different time and a different age, and it doesn't stop when you get off the school bus. It doesn't stop when you get inside your front door. It persists through the internet, through social media, through what we perceive today as being friends telling us these really bullying, nasty comments. And what the Boys and Girls Clubs do is create connection. They create relationships. And I really think at its very source, the solution to these kinds of things are twofold. Number one, creating those connections. And number two, these are pretty bright kids in the world today. Explain it to them. Talk to them about it. Make them increasingly aware of how harmful it is. There will continue to be those that refuse to take the hint. And invariably, those people kind of end up on the outside of society. It never happens on our timetable. Universal justice gets meted out much more slowly than what many of us would like it to do. But I think that if we can continue to create those connections, number one, increase the level of awareness amongst the youth and amongst others as to how harmful and damaging bullying can be, that will at least be some concrete steps that we can take to begin to continue to address this issue.
Thank all of y'all for those answers. Somebody wrote this, so I can't swear to these statistics. I can tell you that they look fairly accurate to me. In 2016, the USA had the following: 60,000 deaths by drugs, 37,461 deaths by motor vehicles, 7,105 handgun murders, 1,604 knife murders, 472 rifle murders. This questioner is wondering why these discussions kind of center around rifles. And if any panelists would like to address that, I'll be glad to. What I'll do is I'll reiterate one of the stats that we're seeing, all of us are seeing, the acceleration of these mass shootings and seemingly an acceleration of the use of the semi-automatic weapons maybe causes us all concern. Semi-automatic rifles, that causes us all concern. But when I look at this, a murder is a murder and a death is a death. So all of those statistics concern me. I want to deal with all of them. But what about the panelists? Let me start with you, Emily.
Well, those look pretty accurate based on the numbers that I'm seeing over and over in the studies, you know, that I read and see. So, you know, by far, handguns cause the most fatalities in this country, gun fatalities in this country. Two-thirds of our gun deaths are suicides. Roughly the other third are homicides. And then we have a number of unintended shootings also that happen every year. When those two African-American teenagers were shot to death on my block in New Orleans, those were handgun shootings. I do think that, in part, it focuses, for the reasons you're saying, assault-style weapons. When you look at what happened in Las Vegas, and of course, that shooter, Stephen Paddock, modified his semi-automatic AR-15s, which are legal, with bump stocks. So those weapons then mimicked fully automatic weapons. He killed 57 people in addition to himself. He shot another 422 people, and he fired over 1,100 rounds in 10 minutes. I'm not trying to shy away from this topic of, restricting certain types of weapons or weapon accessories. I do think that the number one issue in terms, again, of the legal side and legal response is access. I have at least one friend who has an AR-15. He keeps it in his gun safe. I'm not concerned about what he's going to be doing with that gun. But I do think that is why the news focuses so much on these. When you look at EW shootings, the mass shootings that have happened in our history, four of the five have happened since 2012. Three have happened in the last 2 years. Those shootings are involving these sorts of weapons. So I do think that's why. And I do think that there are some legal responses to access in some of those cases. I'm concerned about what is constitutional and what will save lives. And I will just add to that, I'm probably not going to please anyone with these answers. I mean, there are limits to what those types of restrictions can do. When the law has what we just call a ban or an assault weapons ban in place, that's not going to work as a law. That's way too vague and overly broad. The Bushmaster rifle that Adam Lanza used in Newtown, Connecticut to murder 20 6 and 7 year olds and his mother and six teachers. There was an existing ban in Connecticut at the time that defined assault style weapons. Well, Bushmaster designed that weapon around that law. It was legal. So it's not that I think those types of laws are futile and they have passed constitutional muster when they've been looked up in the federal court system. But I do think that the primary issue in these situations really is one of access, and I think that's one of the most viable solutions as a community that we can get behind.
As we sit here today, we have no idea how many assault-style rifles are in the hands of the civilian population of this country. You hear estimates as low as 2 million and as high as 15 or 20 million. We don't know. All the legislation that's been, the gun control legislation that has been proposed in the past, has not envisioned the confiscation of those firearms. So those firearms are going to continue to be out there. Why is there the focus on that? On modern sporting rifles or assault-style rifles? There is power and influence in division. There is money in division. And these kinds of rifles look really, really fierce. They really look like an M16 or an M4 or a fully automatic AK-47. And so they symbolize something. They symbolize a wedge that people can use to create this division, to create this difference of opinion and create an opportunity to exert influence and manipulate emotion. I think that's why there's a focus on it, when, again, the facts argue very strongly that these style of rifles, by and large, are not the issue. It is the inappropriate access to those rifles that are the problem.
I said everything I have to say about that.
We want to go just a couple more minutes. I'm going to read a couple of more quick questions, and then we'll wrap it up. Why do mass shootings take place in gun-free zones? And I think there's an assumption that this questioner has made that connection. I'm not, but I've heard that question asked. And when I look at a lot of these mass shootings, there's certainly a connection, seemingly.
I think 92% of mass shootings happen in gun-free zones. I don't think it's really hard to figure out why that is. Most people that commit theft in a home, if there's a home with a security system sign in the front yard, right next to a home with no security system evident, you can talk to these guys that have been caught doing this. They're going to pick the house that doesn't have the security system. So, you know, a gun-free zone is kind of like carte blanche. The buffet is open. Go in and do what you're going to do. Again, Nick Cruz took 4 minutes to kill 17 people apart from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. Law enforcement was on scene almost immediately. Did not respond appropriately. Stood outside. Didn't go in and interdict. The feedback was, I didn't want to get shot. And what you see in these mass shootings is the sooner you can bring decisive action to bear against the threat, the more quickly the threat is eliminated. And it doesn't mean that the good guy with the gun has to shoot the bad guy with the gun. Sometimes just the presence of that sheepdog will cause that wolf to flee and either break off the attack or end his or her own life. So it really is, it's the path of least resistance for people who want to go out and do these kinds of things.
I also think this then becomes a conversation, or has become a conversation recently, about whether or not teachers should be armed, which I do not think is a good idea for all kinds of reasons. Does not mean that I don't think somebody should be alert and maybe armed in the school to protect the school. So in other words, I'm not opposed to somebody in school having a gun, but certainly not classroom teachers who are there to teach and not to shoot and not even to pretend that they can shoot. I think that will lead us into another kind of conversation, but since that has been very much on people's minds recently.
I would just say, again, I think just like we need to, when we're talking about mass shootings, come to an agreement about what we mean in that conversation about what a mass shooting is. People have different definitions. What do we mean by gun-free zone? Looking back again at these 156 mass shootings that happened between 2009 and 2016, over 60% of them happened in a private residence. If you're defining gun-free zone as a place where civilians are not allowed to have firearms and there is no regular law enforcement presence, it's funny, that number is 10%, so it's kind of flipped, but I think that we're probably using different definitions of gun-free zone. Yeah. But I do think it's just important to keep in mind that, most mass shootings actually happen in someone's home, or they don't happen in schools or movie theaters, even though that's what we hear about most on our news.
Andrew Pollock is the father of one of the students killed at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas School, who feels that one of the steps, and there is no panacea, there is no do this one thing and everything's going to be okay. It's going to take a number of activities and initiatives. But Mr. Pollock lost his daughter in that attack. feels very strongly that we need to harden our schools. There was a wonderful article in the New York Times on March 1st about a school district in Ohio called Sydney City Schools. And I read this article and I researched Sydney City Schools. And it was amazing to me the similarities between the school district in Sydney City and the school district here in Transylvania County. They both have annual budgets of about $37 million. They both have about 3,500 students. And back in 2012, after the Sandy Hook shootings, the Sydney City Schools decided to harden their schools. And this article shares the data. They spent, by the way, hardening targets, hardening schools is something that's supported by Governor John Kasich. I don't know how you felt about a lot of the Republican primaries, but if there was a balanced voice throughout that thing, I thought the Kasich was probably one of them. He supports this. But Sydney City Schools went out and spent $70,000 on equipment, firearms, safes, vests, cameras, and radios. They spent $200,000 in their budget on uniformed armed officers. They spent $100,000 on a liability insurance policy. Wise counsel. If you carry a concealed weapon, I suggest that you get such coverage. They went out and they identified, they labeled their classrooms on the outside of the building so that when people were outside and things were going on inside, the people on the outside with the decisive force could identify which room was under attack. Visitors were buzzed in. And people really, if you talk to people in Sydney whose children or students at Sydney City School, they're wildly supportive of this. In addition, there's 40 other school personnel that are trained. These are teachers, administrators, custodians, trained and have access to firearms within 1 minute. They train monthly. They get extensive pre-qualification training. The law in Florida calls for 132 hours of training before a guardian can go into a school in Florida. I don't know if that's... They're also trained in unarmed defensive tactics. They're trained in first aid. They're trained in conflict de-escalation. I don't know if that's something that Transylvania County Schools wants to do, but I think before we decide we don't want to do it, it's important that we really, again, like we're doing tonight, have a conversation. Go and talk to people that have done it and have seen what it does, and see if it's something we want to try. That represents about 1% of Sydney City Schools' annual education budget. They've been doing it since 2012. There's about 100 school districts across the country right now in 12 or 13 states that do have programs similar to this across the country.
So this is a question that I am qualified to answer myself. I'll show it to you. It's blank. So the answer is yes. Whoever gave it to me. For me, it's yes. There's a question in a stream of questions. I'm going to read this, and if the panelists want to respond to it, I'll give them that opportunity. But I think this is one of those complicated questions and answers that begins at the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Second Amendment and continues through to this day. And my response to this is smarter people than me need to come up with solutions on this. In the meantime, I'm going to work on what I can do, and I'll get to that in just a second. What would be the challenges involved in instituting a universal background check system? And I'm assuming universal means nationwide. And let's roll that into the mental illness background check and all of those things that we think may help us prevent the guns from getting into the wrong hands. What's the response to that, Carla?
Well, whoops. Okay. I don't see that universal background checks have anything whatsoever to do with the Constitution. I mean, in other words, I think that that is not a problem from a constitutional perspective. Certainly, even in the Heller decision in 2008, which is where the majority said that citizens of Washington, D.C. could have handguns in their homes, and that was basically what that decision said. They even said then that there are any number of things that can be done to regulate firearms in this country, and that is up to the states, or of course the feds if they wish. So there's nothing that would prohibit the development of a comprehensive universal background check system in this country from a constitutional perspective, right?
That's right. That's right. And I just from the legal side of it, that's our courts have been, from Supreme Court down, clear about that. If that's what the question meant, on the practical side, in terms of improving the existing system and working to close those loopholes, and this is something where I think you are the best qualified person at the state to speak to, but what the standard practices are. So if y'all will recall one of our five deadliest mass shootings in this country, Sutherland Springs, Texas, back in November, that shooter, he was in the Air Force, he was convicted, he was court-martially convicted, he had fractured his toddler son, his stepson's skull. He had beat his first wife. He's a textbook example of someone who should not have legal access to a gun. And he would have failed a background check, but the military, the Air Force did not, their personnel did not do their due diligence in that situation. And they didn't enter that into the FBI database that our National Instant Check System picks up. So I think that in addition to improving laws and reforming some of our laws, we need to also look at what are our practices. I think that across different institutions and how information gets transferred from law enforcement to courts to gun dealers. I mean, I think this is where gun dealers are a critical part of the conversation. I don't know. I think the question was more directed at the legal side, but I think also just how does our background check system work? I think your average citizen can't answer that question.
80% of these numbers might be a little bit old, but I believe 80% of NRA membership supports universal background checks. It's not something that's really controversial. I've never done a background check on anybody. These guys have. I don't know how complex it is, how prone to breakdown it might be. Yeah. We have a tendency in this country to pass a law or implement a regulation and then not invest in the systems and the technology needed to make it effective. You know, the guy in the Air Force, if they had just said this guy was dishonorably discharged, he could not have legally purchased a firearm. They didn't. The system failed. Every time this happens, what we need to do is we kind of need to do a post-mortem on that particular incident, figure out what went wrong, and then do our best to fix it. And Emily's exactly right. It is going to take input from the retailers of firearms. It's going to take input from, you know, this is kind of dicey from a privacy issue, but gosh, our mental health care systems don't talk to our regulatory or licensing systems when it comes to firearms. Our education system doesn't talk to our regulatory agencies when it comes to firearms, and doesn't talk, you know, there was controversy where doctors were being asked to talk about guns in the home. You know, people were concerned, I think in some instances rightfully so, over the invasion of privacy that this creates. And is this the camel's nose under the tent flap? But once that nose is under the tent flap, the rest of the camel's coming into the tent, and pretty soon it's going to be, well, you told your doctor you got a gun, now we want it. I mean, those are the types of things we have to consider. But you know what? We're a nation of pretty smart people. And I think we're a nation of pretty well-intentioned people. And if we can figure out just how to start the discussion, sustain it over time, I think we can come up with a set of really meaningful, impactful solutions.
I think you should talk about the background checks from your perspective. As you know, I have that.
Yeah, we're about out of time. The background checks, law enforcement, our department doesn't get involved in gun purchases. I know Sheriff Mahoney intervenes or at least reviews it when somebody wants to conceal carry. But this is on a system that gun dealers deal with. The background checks are done through a form that the person that wants to purchase it fills out, and then those background checks are done in a database that meets that requirement. It has to do with their criminal history and their mental history. Part of it is that they provide the proper information, but most of it is a system that seems to be fairly effective. 3 million plus people have been turned down when they've applied for the gun because they were not suited by background. So there seems to be a pretty strong success rate in that. When we add up all the mass shootings, the ones that exceed 3 people, it's 4 or more. That's the common definition, not including the shooter. It's a pretty small number of people, but the damage they've done is immeasurable. Here we are, and we all hurt from those situations, and we all ask ourselves, what can we do? So I'm going to wrap this up by giving some ideas. I think you've seen the panel support virtually all of this. When we're looking for solutions, when we collectively, different sides of the issue, and maybe some of us haven't chosen the side, civility is the key. And it really is being kind to each other and listening, because we're going to learn something if we do. Find common ground and build upon that. Safe storage and restricted access of firearms is key for those of us that have firearms in our homes. Be vigilant with the safety rules. Accept philosophical differences and seek to understand each other first, and then seek to be understood. Think of intervening in somebody's life as a collective process. Family, neighborhood, churches, social groups, city, county, state, country, world. I look for people to help every day. Who are the people that need help from somebody like me, seemingly more than others? I look for single parents, especially the ones with small children, especially the ones with more than one small child. They are constantly overwhelmed. Sometimes a smile or a very small thing that I do to serve them makes a big difference. And by the way, this Saturday we have a community cleanup where we're going to interact with just those types of opportunities. Starts at 8 a.m. at the police department. We brief. We give our participants some food, water, and a little coffee. And we give them assignments in our community. And we're looking for more people to help. So if you know of somebody, let us know. What do we do to change where we're going? Let me tell you what I say to you, the community. You have value. The people in our community are all, they all have a place, and they all have value. Let's help grow their skills and help them understand the world. Let's get help when we need help from others. Let's stay connected, and then let's show compassion to one another. And at the end of this, I've got gun locks for anybody that would like them. They're free. The most valuable part of this is not the lock itself. It's the information booklet that comes with it. It really is informative. So if you need a gun lock, please get it. If you don't, the company is Project Child Safe, and all of this packet is online. So I'm going to go to the panelists. Carter, what would you like to say around that?
I think this is a group. This evening has been, to me, a good thing, a sign of hope, a sign of community solidarity. I do hope we can figure out how to keep it going in a way that focuses perhaps not only on gun violence, but on community building across the lands and divide us on all kinds of issues, including this one. Because that's how we're going to save ourselves, all of us in this society. We need each other very badly, and it's only together that we can do this. So thank you very much.
And I would echo Carter. I want to thank all of y'all for coming out tonight. I know this is a very difficult topic, and a lot of us, probably everyone in this room, we have strong feelings about it. But I think it, first and foremost, when you have that conversation, like Phil said, to first listen and allow one another to really talk about why you feel the way you do, and what matters to you, and really seeing that, I think, and validating that is so important. And ultimately, I think, in terms of what we can accomplish as individuals and as a community, if we're doing that, we're still not going to get to that point where we agree with everything. I think that's less important than actually just having a conversation and respecting each other.
I also want to thank everybody for coming out tonight. When we were planning this event, we asked ourselves how many people we thought would show up, and it turns out we were spot on. We said between 10 and 200. And so it looks like we've fallen somewhere in that range. And as I was thinking about closing comments, I wanted to come up with something really wise and insightful. But since I'm not that type of a person, I decided instead to go to the internet, and I looked up one of my favorite quotes from John Stuart Mill in his work on liberty. And this really, to me, kind of is emblematic of what we've done here tonight. He said, "He who knows only his own side of the case knows little of that. His reasons may be good, and no one may have been able to refute them. But if he is equally unable to refute the reasons on the opposite side, if he does not so much as know what they are, he has no ground for preferring either opinion. Nor is it enough that he should hear the opinions of adversaries from his own teachers, presented as they state them and accompanied by what they offer as refutations. He must be able to hear them from persons who actually believe them. He must know them in their most plausible and persuasive form." And that's what we tried to do tonight, is share our opinions from where we're coming from. We think that this is really timely. It's important. The solutions to the challenges that confront us as a community and as a society are not found in Washington, D.C. They're found right here in Brevard and Transylvania County. And so let's establish those connections. Let's build those relationships. Let's acknowledge and value our differences of opinions and use those differences to craft vastly superior solutions. So again, thank you all very much for being here tonight.
Please join me in thanking our panelists. What I'll take from me tonight is their wisdom and their model of civility and community. So thank you very much for being here. Thank you.